dressed for high ceremonial. And it wasn't long before they heard sounds telling them that the mock games were over. No doubt the prizes would be given indoors this time, at the feast. She wondered if Lancelot had won them all again in honour of his king. Or, she thought sourly, his queen. And could one call that honour? They turned to leave the chamber, and as they left the room, Vivian touched her hand gently. "You will return to Avalon with me, will you not, dear child?"
"If Arthur will let me go."
"Morgaine, you are a priestess of Avalon, and you need not ask leave even of the High King to come and go as it pleases you. A High King is a leader in battle. He doesn't own the lives of his subjects, or even of his subject kings, as if he were one of those eastern tyrants who thinks the world is his and the life of every man and woman in it. I will tell him I have need of you in Avalon, and we will see what he answers to that."
Morgaine felt herself choking with unshed tears. Oh, to return to Avalon, to go home. But even as she held Vivian's hand, she couldn't believe she was truly to go there after this day. Later she was to say, "I knew. I knew."
And recognised the despair and foreboding that struck her at the words. But at the moment, she was certain it was only her own fear, the sense that she wasn't worthy of what she had cast away. Then they went down into Arthur's great hall for the Pentecost feasting. It was Camelot, Morgaine thought, as she had never seen it before, and perhaps would never see it again. The great round table, Leodegrance's wedding gift, was now set in a hall worthy of its majesty. The halls had been hung with silks and banners, and a trick of the arrangement made it so that all eyes were drawn to where Arthur sat, at the high seat at the far end of the hall. For this day he had brought Gareth to sit beside him and his queen, and all the knights and companions were ringed together, the companions in fine clothing, their weapons gleaming, the ladies garbed brightly as flowers. One after another the petty kings came, knelt before Arthur, and brought him gifts. Morgaine watched Arthur's face, grave, solemn, gentle. She looked sideways at Vivian. Surely she must see that Arthur had grown into a good king, not one to be lightly judged, even by Avalon or the Druids. But who was she to weigh causes between Arthur and Avalon? She felt the old tremor of disquiet, as in the old days at Avalon, when she was being taught to open her mind to the sight that would use her as its instrument, and found herself wishing, without understanding why, would that Vivian were 100 leagues from here. She looked around the companions, Gawain, sandy and bulldog strong, smiling at his newly knighted brother. Gareth, shining somehow like new minted gold. Lancelot looked dark and beautiful, and as if his thoughts were somewhere at the other end of the world. Pellinore, greying and gentle, his daughter Elaine waiting on him. And now one came to Arthur's throne who wasn't one of the companions. Morgaine hadn't seen him before, but she saw that Guinevere recognised him and shrank away. "I am the only living son of King Leodegrance," he said, "and brother to your queen, Arthur. I demand that you recognise my claim to the Summer Country."
Arthur said mildly,
"You do not make demands in this court, Meleagrant. I will consider your request and take counsel of my queen, and it may be that I will consent to name you her regent. But I cannot deliver you judgment now." "Then it may be I shall not wait for your judgment," shouted Meleagrant.
He was a big man who had come to the feast wearing not only sword and dagger, but a great bronze battle-axe. He was dressed in ill-tanned furs and skins,
and looked savage and grim as any Saxon bandit. His two men-at-arms looked even more ruffianly than he did himself.
"I'm the only surviving son of Leodegrance."
Guinevere leaned forward and whispered to Arthur.
The king said,
"My lady tells me that her father always denied he had begotten you. Rest assured we shall have this matter looked into, and if your claim is good, we will allow it. For the moment, Sir Meleagrant, I ask you to trust to my justice and join me in feasting. We will take this up with our counsellors and do you such justice as we can."
"Feasting be damned," said Meleagrant angrily. "I came not here to eat comfits and look at ladies and watch grown men making sport like boys. I tell you, Arthur, I am king of that country, and if you dare dispute my claim, it will be the worse for you and for your lady."
He laid his hand on the hilt of his great battle-axe, but Kai and Gareth were immediately there, pinioning his arms behind him.
"No steel's to be drawn in the king's hall," said Kai roughly,
while Gareth twisted the axe out of his hand and set it at the foot of Arthur's chair.
"Go to your seat, man, and eat your meat. We'll have order at the round table, and when our king has said he'll do you justice, you'll wait on his good pleasure."
They spun him roughly round, but Meleagrant struggled free of their hands and said,
"To hell with your feast, and to hell with your justice, then, and to hell with your round table and all your companions."
He left the axe and turned his back, stamping down all the length of the hall. Kai took a step after him, and Gawain half rose, but Arthur motioned him to sit down again.
"Let him go," he said. "We will deal with him at the proper time. Lancelot, as my lady's champion, it may well fall to you to deal with that usurping churl."
"It will be my pleasure, my king," said Lancelot, starting up as if he had been half asleep. But Morgain suspected that he hadn't the slightest idea what he had agreed to.
The heralds at the door were still proclaiming that all men should draw near for the king's justice. There was a brief comical interlude when a farmer came in and told how he and his neighbour had quarrelled over a small windmill on the borders of their property.
"We couldn't agree, sir,"
he said, twisting his rough woollen hat between his hands.
"So him and me, we made it out that the king had made all this country safe to have a windmill in. So I said I'd come here, sir, and see what you'd say. And we listened to it."
Amid good-natured laughter, the matter was settled. But Morgaine noticed that Arthur alone didn't laugh, but listened seriously, gave judgment, and when the man had thanked him and gone away with many bows and thanks, only then did he let his face break into a smile.
"Kai, see that they give the fellow something to eat in the kitchens before he goes home. He had a long walk here."
He sighed.
"Who is next to ask justice? God grant it be something fitter my solving. Will they come next to ask my advice in horse breeding, or something of that sort?"
"It shows what they think of their king, Arthur," said Taliesin. "But you should make it known that they should go to their local lord and see that your subjects are also responsible for justice in your name."
He raised his head to see the next petitioner.
"But this may be more worthy of the king's attention after all, for it is a woman, and I doubt not, in some trouble."
Arthur motioned her forward. A young woman, self-assured, haughty, reared to courtly ways. She had no attendant except for a small and ugly dwarf, no taller than 3 feet, but with broad shoulders and well-muscled, carrying a short and powerful axe. She bowed to the king and told her story. She served a lady who had been left, as had so many others after the years of war, alone in the world. Her estate was northward, near to the old Roman wall, which stretched mile after mile, with ruined forts and mile castles, now mostly decrepit and falling down. But a gang of five brothers, ruffians all, had refortified five of the castles and were laying the whole countryside to waste. And now one of them, who had a fancy to call himself the Red Knight of Redlands, was laying siege to her lady, and his brothers were worse than he was.
"Red Knight! Ha!" said Gawain. "I know that gentleman. I fought with him when I came southward from my last visit to Lot's country, and I barely got away with my life. Arthur, it might be well to send an army to clean out those fellows. There's no law in that part of the world."
Arthur frowned and nodded, but young Gareth rose from his seat. "My lord Arthur, that is on the fringes of my father's country. You promised me a quest. Keep the promise, my king, and send me to help this lady defend her countryside against these evil fellows." The young woman looked at Gareth, his shining beardless face, and the white silk robe he had put on for his knighting, and she broke into laughter.
"You? Why, you're a child.
I didn't know the great High King was taking overgrown children to serve at his table." Gareth blushed like a child. He had indeed handed Arthur's cup to the king. It was a service young, well-born boys, fostered at court, all performed at high feasts. Gareth hadn't yet remembered it was no longer his duty, and Arthur, who liked the boy, hadn't reproved him. The woman drew herself up.
"My lord and king, I came to ask for one or more of your great knights with a reputation in battle which would daunt this Red Knight. Gawain, or Lancelot, or Balin, one of those who is known as a great fighter against the Saxons. Are you going to let your very kitchen boys mock me, sire?"
Arthur said, "My companion Gareth is no kitchen boy, madam. He is brother to Sir Gawain, and he promises to be as good a knight as his brother, or better. I did indeed promise him the first quest that I could honourably give him, and I will send him with you." "Gareth," he said gently, "I charge you to ride with this lady, to guard her against the dangers of the road, and when you come to her country, to help her lady to organise her country in defence against these villains. If you need help, you may send me a messenger, but no doubt she has fighting men enough. They need only someone with knowledge and skill at strategy, and this you have learned from Kai and Gawain. Madam, I give you a good man to help you."
She didn't quite dare to answer the king, but she scowled at Gareth fiercely. He said formally,
"Thank you, my lord Arthur. I will put the fear of God into these rascals who are troubling the countryside there." He bowed to Arthur and turned to the lady, but she had turned her back and stormed out of the hall.
Lancelot said in a low voice,
"He's young for all that, sir. Shouldn't you send Balin or Balin or someone more experienced?"
Arthur shook his head.
"I truly think Gareth can do it, and I prefer that no one of my companions is favoured over another. It should be enough for the lady to know that one of them is coming to help her people."
Arthur leaned back and signalled to Kai to serve his plate.
"Giving justice is hungry work. Are there no more petitioners?"
"There is one, my lord Arthur," said Vivian quietly,
and rose from her place among the queen's ladies. Morgaine began to rise and attend her, but Vivian gestured her back. She looked taller than she was because she held herself so straight. And part of it was glamour, the glamour of Avalon. Her hair, all white, was braided high on her head. At her side hung the little sickle-shaped knife, the knife of a priestess, and on her brow blazed the mark of the goddess, the shining crescent moon. Arthur looked at her for a moment in surprise, then recognised her and gestured her to come forward.
"Lady of Avalon, it is long since you honoured this court with your presence. Come, sit beside me, kinswoman, and tell me how I may best serve you."
"'by showing honour to Avalon as you are sworn to do,' said Vivian. "'Her voice was very clear and low, "'but the trained voice of a priestess, "'it could be heard to the farthest corners of the hall. "'My king, I bid you look now on that sword you bear, "'and think on those who laid it in your hand, "'and what you swore.' In later years, when all that had befallen that day was talked of far and wide, no two of the hundreds in that hall could agree on what had happened first. Morgaine saw Boleyn rise in his place and rush forward. She saw a hand snatch up the great axe Meleagrant had left leaning against the throne. Then there was a scuffle and a cry, and she heard her own scream as the great axe came whirling down. But she didn't see the blow. Only Vivian's white hair suddenly red with blood as she crumpled and fell without even a cry. Then the hall was full of shouts and screams. Lancelot and Gawain had Boleyn struggling in their grasp. Morgaine had her own dagger in her hand and rushed forward. But Kevin gripped at her hard, his twisted fingers clutching at her wrist. "Morgaine, Morgaine, no, it is too late," he said. And his voice was roughened with sobs. "Caridwen, Mother Goddess. No, no, look not on her now, Morgaine." He tried to turn her away, but Morgaine stood frozen as if turned to stone, listening to Boleyn howling obscenities at the top of his voice. Kai said abruptly, "Look to the Lord Taliesin." The old man had slithered down, fainting in his seat. Kai bent and steadied him, then, murmuring a word of apology to Arthur, seized the king's own cup and poured the wine down the old man's throat. Kevin let Morgaine go and stumbled awkwardly to the side of the ancient druid, bending over him. Morgaine thought, "I should go to him." But it was as if her feet were frozen to the floor. She couldn't take a single step. She stared at the fainting old man so that she needn't look back at that horrible red-stained pool on the floor, soaking through robes and hair and long cloak. In that last instant, Vivian had seized her own small sickle knife. Her hand lay on it now, stained with her own blood. There was so much blood, so much. Her skull had been cloven in half, and there was blood. Blood on the throne poured out like an animal for sacrifice here at the foot of Arthur's throne. Arthur finally found his voice. "You wretched man," he said hoarsely. "What have you done? This is murder, cold murder before the very throne of your king." "Murder, you say?" Boleyn said in his thick, harsh voice. "Yes, yeah, she was the most foul murderess in this kingdom. She deserved death twice over. I have rid your kingdom of a wicked and evil sorceress, my king."
Arthur looked more angry than grieved.
"The Lady of the Lake was my friend and my benefactor. How dare you speak so of my kinswoman, she who helped to set me on my throne?" I call the Lord Lancelot himself to witness if she didn't compass the death of my mother," Boleyn said. "A good and pious Christian woman, Priscilla by name, and foster mother to your own brother Balin. And she murdered my mother. I tell you, she murdered her by her evil sorceries."
His face worked. The big man was weeping like a child.
"She murdered my mother, I tell you. And I have avenged her as a knight should do."
Lancelot closed his eyes in horror. His face contorted, but he didn't weep.
"My Lord Arthur, this man's life belongs to me. Let me here take vengeance for my mother."
"And my mother's sister," said Gawain.
"And mine," Gaheris added.
Morgaine's frozen trance broke. She cried,
"No, Arthur, let me have him. He has murdered the lady before your throne. Let a woman of Avalon avenge the blood of Avalon.
Look yonder, how the Lord Taliesin lies stricken. It is like that he has murdered our grandsire, too.
Sister, sister.
Arthur held out his hand to Morgain.
No, no, sister.
No. Give me your dagger. Morgain stood shaking her head, her dagger still in her hand. Taliesin suddenly rose to take it from her with his own trembling old fingers.
No, Morgain. No more bloodshed here. The goddess knows. It is enough. Her blood has been spilled as sacrifice to Avalon in this hall.
Sacrificed?
Yes, sacrificed to God, as God shall strike down all these evil sorceresses and their gods,
cried Boleyn in a frenzy.
Let me have that one too, my lord Arthur. Purge this court of all their evil wizard line.
He struggled so violently that Lancelot and Gawain could hardly hold him, and signalled to Kai, who came and helped them cast Boleyn down, struggling still, before the throne.
Quiet,
Lancelot said, jerking his head around.
I warn you, one hand laid on the Merlin or Morgain, and I'll have your head, whatever Arthur may say. Yes, my lord Arthur. And die at your hands for it afterward, if you will have it so.
His face was drawn with anguish and despair.
My lord king,
Boleyn howled,
I beg you, let me strike down all these wizards and sorcerers in the name of the Christ who hates them all.
Lancelot struck Boleyn heavily across the mouth. The man gasped and was silent, blood streaming from a broken lip.
By your leave, my lord.
Lancelot unfastened his rich cloak and gently covered the ghastly, drained corpse of his mother. Arthur seemed to breathe easier now that the corpse was out of sight. Only Morgain went on staring wide-eyed at the lifeless huddle, now covered with the crimson cloak Lancelot had worn for the holiday. Blood. Blood on the foot of the king's throne. Blood poured out on the hearth. Somewhere it seemed to Morgain that she could hear Raven shrieking. Arthur said quietly,
Look to the lady, Morgain. She will faint.
And Morgain felt hands gently helping her to a seat, and someone holding a cup to her lips. She started to push it away, and then it seemed she heard Vivian's voice saying,
Drink it. A priestess must keep her strength and will.
Obediently she drank, hearing Arthur's voice, stern and solemn.
Boleyn, whatever your reasons... No, no more. I heard what you said. Not a word. You are either a madman or a cold-blooded murderer. Whatever you may say, you have slain my kinswoman and drawn steel before your High King at Pentecost. Still, I will not have you murdered where you stand. Lancelot, put up your sword.
Lancelot slid his sword back into its scabbard.
I will do your will, my lord. But if you do not punish this murder, then I beg leave to depart from your court. Oh, I will punish it.
Arthur's face was grim.
Boleyn, are you sane enough to listen to me? Then this is your doom. I banish you for ever from this court. Let this lady's body be made ready and put on a horse bier, and I charge you to take it to Glastonbury, and tell all your tale to the Archbishop, and do such penance as he shall lay on you. You spoke but now of God and Christ, but no Christian king allows private vengeance to be taken by the sword before his throne of justice. Do you hear what I say, Boleyn? Once my knight and companion.
Boleyn bent his head. His nose had been broken by Lancelot's blow. His mouth was streaming blood, and he spoke thickly through a broken tooth.
I hear you, my lord king. I will go.
He sat with his head bowed. Arthur gestured to the servants.
I beg you, bring someone to remove her poor body.
Morgain broke away from the hands that held her and knelt beside Vivian.
"'My lord, I beg you, allow me to ready her for burial.' "'And struggled to hold back the tears she dared not shed. "'This wasn't Vivian, this broken dead thing, "'the hand like a shrunken claw still clutching the sickle dagger of Avalon. "'She took up the dagger, kissed it, and slid it into her own belt. "'This, and only this, would she keep. "'Great merciful mother, I knew we could never go together to Avalon.' She would not weep. She felt Lancelot close beside her. He muttered, "God's mercy, Balin isn't here, to lose mother and foster brother in one moment of madness. But if Balin had been here, it might not have happened. Is there any God or any mercy?" Her heart ached for Lancelot's anguish. He had feared and hated his mother, but he had worshipped her too, as the very face of the goddess. A part of her wanted to pull Lancelot into her arms, comfort him, let him weep. Yet there was rage, too. He had defied his mother. How dared he grieve for her now? Taliesin was kneeling beside them, and he said in his broken old voice, "Let me help you, children. It is my right." And they moved aside as he bowed his head to murmur an ancient prayer of passage. Arthur rose in his place. "There will be no more feasting this day. We have had too much tragedy for a feast. Those of you who are hungry, finish your meal and go quietly." He came slowly down to where the body lay. His hand rested gently on Morgaine's shoulder. She felt it there through her numb misery. She could hear the other guests quietly leaving the hall, one after another, and through the rustle she heard softly the sound of a harp. Only one pair of hands in Britain played such a harp. And at last she melted, and tears streamed from her eyes as Kevin's harp played the dirge for the lady. And to that sound, Vivian, priestess of Avalon, was slowly borne from the great hall of Camelot. Morgaine, walking beside the bier, looked back only once at the great hall and the round table, and the solitary, bowed figure of Arthur standing alone beside the harper. And through all her grief and despair, she thought, "Vivian never gave to Arthur the message of Avalon. This is the hall of a Christian king, and now there is no one who will say otherwise. How Guinevere would rejoice if she knew." His hands were outstretched. She didn't know. Perhaps he was praying. She saw the serpents tattooed about his wrists and thought of the young stag and the new-made king who had come to her with the blood of the king stag on his hands and face. And for a moment it seemed to her that she could hear the mocking voice of the fairy queen. And then there was no sound but the anguished lamenting of Kevin's harp, and Lancelot weeping at her side as they bore Vivian forth to rest. Morgaine speaks. "I followed the body of Vivian from the great hall of the Round Table, weeping for only the second time that I could remember. And yet later that night I quarrelled with Kevin. Working with the Queen's women, I prepared Vivian's body for burial. Guinevere sent her women, and she sent linen and spices and a velvet pall, but she didn't come herself. That was just as well. The priestess of Avalon should be laid to rest by attendant priestesses. I long for my sisters from the House of Maidens, but at least no Christian hand should touch her. When I was done, Kevin came to watch by the body. I have sent Taliesin to rest. I have that authority now, as the Merlin of Britain. He is very old and very feeble. It's a miracle that his heart didn't fail this day. I fear he will not long outlive her. Balin is quiet now," he added. "I think perhaps he knows what he did. But it is sure that it was done in a fit of madness.
He is ready to ride with her body to Glastonbury, and serve such penance as the Archbishop shall decree."
I stared at him in outrage. "And you will have it so? That she shall fall into the hands of the Church?"
"I care not what happens to that murderer," I said. "But Vivian must be taken to Avalon."
I swallowed hard so that I wouldn't weep again. "We should have ridden together to Avalon."
"Arthur has decreed," said Kevin quietly, "that she shall be buried before the church at Glastonbury, where all can see."
I shook my head, unbelieving.
Were all men mad this day?
"Vivian must lie in Avalon," I said, "where all the priestesses of the Mother have been buried since time began. And she was Lady of the Lake."
"She was also Arthur's friend and benefactor," said Kevin, "and he will have it that her tomb shall be made a place of pilgrimage."
He put out his hand that I shouldn't speak.
"No, hear me, Morgaine. There is reason in what he says. Never has there been so grave a crime in Arthur's reign. He cannot hide away her burial place out of sight and out of mind. She must be buried where all men may know of the king's justice and the justice of the church."
"And you will allow this?"
"Morgaine, my dearest," he said gently, "it is not for me to allow or to refuse. Arthur is the High King, and it is his will that is done in this realm."
"And Taliesin holds his peace? Or is this why you have sent him to his rest, so that he might be out of the way while you do this blasphemy with the king's connivance? Will you have Vivian buried with Christian burial and Christian rites, she who was Lady of the Lake, buried by these folk who imprison their god within stone walls? Vivian chose me after her to be Lady of the Lake, and I forbid it. I forbid it, do you hear me?"
Kevin said quietly, "Morgaine, no, listen to me, my dear. Vivian died without naming her successor."
"You were there that day she said she had chosen me."
"But you were not in Avalon when she died, and you have renounced that place," Kevin said.
And his words fell on my head like cold rain, so that I shivered. He stared at the bier and Vivian's body, which lay covered there. Nothing I could do could make that face fit to be seen in death.
"Vivian died with no successor named to her place, and so it falls to me, as the Merlin of Britain, to declare what will be done. And if this is Arthur's will, only the Lady of the Lake... And forgive me, my dear, that I say it, but there is now no lady in Avalon could speak out against what I say. I concede that the king has reason for what he wishes. Vivian spent all her life to bring about a peaceful rule of law in this land.
She came to reprove Arthur that he had forsaken Avalon," I cried in despair. "She died with her mission unfinished. And now you would have it that she should lie in Christian ground within the sound of church bells, so that they should triumph over her in death as in life?"
"Morgaine, Morgaine, my poor girl."
Kevin held out his hands to me, the misshapen hands which had so often caressed me.
"I loved her too, believe me, but she is dead. She was a great woman. She spent her life for this land. Do you think it matters to her where her empty shell shall lie? She has gone to whatever awaits her beyond death. And knowing her, I know that it can only be good that awaits her. Do you think she would grudge it that her body should lie where it can best serve those purposes she spent her life to accomplish? That the king's justice should triumph over all the evil in this land?"
His rich, caressing, musical voice was so eloquent that I hesitated for a moment. Vivian was gone. It was only those same Christians who made much of consecrated or unconsecrated ground, as if all the earth, which is the breast of the Mother, was not holy.
I wanted to fall into his arms and weep there for the only mother I had ever known, for the wreck of my own hopes that I might return to Avalon at her side. Weep for all I had cast away, and the breaking of my own life.
But what he said then made me start away in horror.
"Vivian was old," he said, "and she had dwelt in Avalon, sheltered from the real world. I have had to live with Arthur in the world where battles are won and real decisions made. Morgaine, my dearest, listen to me. It is too late to demand that Arthur keep his pledge to Avalon in that same form he gave it. Time passes. The sound of church bells covers this land, and the people are content to have it so. Who are we to say that this is not the will of the gods that lie behind the gods? Whether we wish it or no, my dearest love, this is a Christian land, and we who honour Vivian's memory will do her no good by making it known to all men that she came hither to make impossible demands of the king."
"Impossible demands?" I wrenched my hands away. "How dare you?"
"Morgaine, listen to reason."
"Not reason, but treason. If Taliesin heard this..."
"I speak as I have heard Taliesin himself speak," he said gently. "Vivian did not live in order to undo what she has done, to create a land at peace. Whether it is called Christian or Druid doesn't matter. The will of the goddess will be done over all, whatever name men may call her. Who are you to say that it wasn't the will of the goddess that Vivian was struck down before she could spread strife again in a land that has come to peace and successful compromise? I tell you, it shall not be torn again by strife. And if Vivian had not been struck down by Boleyn, I would myself have spoken against what she asked. And I think Taliesin would have said as much."
"How dare you speak for Taliesin?"
"Taliesin himself named me Merlin of Britain," said Kevin, "and he must therefore have trusted me to act for him when he could not speak for himself."
"Next you will say you've become a Christian. Why wear you not beads and a crucifix?"
he said in such a gentle voice that I could have wept. "Do you truly think it would make such a great difference, Morgaine, if I did so?" I knelt before him as I had done a year ago, pressed his broken hand to my breast. "Kevin, I have loved you. For that I beg you, be faithful now to Avalon and to Vivian's memory. Come with me now, tonight. Do not this travesty, but accompany me to Avalon, where the Lady of the Lake shall lie with the other priestesses of the goddess." He bent over me. I could feel the anguished tenderness in his misshapen hands. "Morgaine, I cannot. My dearest, will you not be calm and listen to the voice of reason in what I am saying?" I stood up, flinging off his weak grip, and raising my arms, summoned the power of the goddess. I heard my voice thrumming with the power of a priestess. "Kevin, in her name who came to you, in the name of the manhood she has given you, I lay obedience on you. Your allegiance is not to Arthur nor to Britain, but only to the goddess and to your vows. Come now, leave this place. Come with me to Avalon, bearing her body." I could see in the shadows the very glow of the goddess around me. For a moment, Kevin knelt shuddering, and I know that in another moment he would have obeyed. And then, I know not what happened. Perhaps it crossed my mind, "No, I'm not worthy. I have no right. I have forsaken Avalon. I cast it away. By what right, then, do I command the Merlin of Britain?" The spell broke. Kevin made a harsh, abrupt gesture, awkwardly rising to his feet. "Woman, you do not command me. You who have renounced Avalon, by what right do you presume to give orders to the Merlin? Rather should you kneel before me." He thrust me away with both hands.
Tempt me no more.
He turned his back and limped away, the shadows making wavering, misshapen movements on the wall as he moved from the room. I watched him go, too stricken even to weep. And 4 days later, Vivian was buried with all the rites of the church on the Holy Isle in Glastonbury. But I did not go thither. Never, I swore, should I step foot upon that isle of the priests.
Arthur mourned her sincerely, and built for her a great tomb and a cairn, swearing that one day he and Guinevere should lie there at her side. As for Boleyn, the Archbishop Patricius laid it upon him that he should make a pilgrimage to Rome and the Holy Lands. But before he could go into exile, Balin heard the tale from Lancelot and hunted him down, and the foster brothers fought one with another. And Boleyn was killed at once with a single stroke. But Balin took cold in his wounds, and didn't survive him a whole day. So Vivian, so they said when a song was made of it, was avenged. But what of that, when she lay in a Christian tomb? And I didn't even know whom they had chosen as Lady of the Lake in her place, for I couldn't return to Avalon. I wasn't worthy of Lancelot. I wasn't worthy even of Kevin. I could not tempt him to do his true duty to Avalon. I should have gone to Taliesin and begged him, even on my knees, to take me back to Avalon, that I might atone for all my faults and return again to the shrine of the goddess. But before the summer was ended, Taliesin was gone too. I think he never knew for certain that Vivian was dead, because even after she was buried, he spoke as if she would come soon and return with him to Avalon. And he spoke of my mother, too, as if she lived and was a little girl in the House of Maidens. And at summer's end he died peacefully and was buried at Camelot. And even the bishop mourned him as a wise and learned man. And in the winter after that, we heard that Meleagrant had set himself up to rule as king in the summer country. But when spring came, Arthur was away on a mission to the south, and Lancelot, too, had ridden out to see the king's castle at Caerleon, when Meleagrant sent a messenger under a flag of truce, begging that his sister Guinevere should come and speak with him about the rule of that country, over which they both had a claim. Chapter 4
I would feel safer, and I think my lord the king would like it better if Lancelot were here to ride with you,
Kai said soberly.
At Pentecost yonder fellow would have drawn steel in this hall before his king, and he wouldn't await the king's justice. Brother of yours or no, I like it not that you ride alone with only your lady and your chamberlain.
He isn't my brother, Guinevere said. His mother was the king's mistress for a time, but he put her away because he found her with another man. She claimed, and perhaps told her son, that Leodegrance was his father. The king never acknowledged it. If he were an honourable man, and such as my lord would trust, perhaps he could be regent for me as well as any other. But I will not allow him to profit by such a lie.
Would you trust yourself, then, in his hands, Guinevere? Asked Morgaine quietly.
Guinevere looked at Kai and Morgaine, shaking her head. Why did Morgaine look so calm and unafraid?
Was Morgaine never afraid of anything, never touched by any emotion behind that cool, unreadable face? Rationally, she knew that Morgaine, like all mortal flesh, must sometimes suffer from pain, fear, grief, anger. Yet only twice had she actually seen emotion in Morgaine, and that long ago. Once, when Morgaine had fallen into trance and dreamed of blood on the hearth, then she had cried out in fear. And once, when Vivian was slain here before her eyes, and she had sunk down fainting.
Guinevere said, I trust him not at all, except to be the greedy impostor he is. But think, Morgaine,
All his claim is based upon the fact that he is my brother. Should he offer me the slightest insult, or treat me as anything less than his honoured sister, his claim is proved a lie. So he dares do nothing else than welcome me as his honoured sister and queen. Do you see?
Morgaine shrugged. I wouldn't trust him even so far as that.
No doubt, like the Merlin, you have sorcery to give you knowledge of what may come if I do.
Morgaine said indifferently, It needs no sorcery to know that a villain is a villain, and no supernatural wisdom that bids me not let the nearest rogue hold my wallet for me.
Whatever Morgaine said, Guinevere always felt compelled to do precisely other. Always she felt that Morgaine thought her a fool without the wit to lace her own shoes. Did Morgaine think that she, Guinevere, couldn't settle a matter of state when Arthur was absent? Yet she had hardly been able to face Morgaine since that ill-starred Beltane a year ago, when she had begged her sister-in-law for a charm against her barrenness. Morgaine had told her that charms often work as you wouldn't have them work. Now, whenever she looked on Morgaine, she thought her sister-in-law must be remembering it too.
God punishes me, perhaps for meddling with sorcery, perhaps for that wicked night.
And, as always, when she allowed the faintest memory of that time to come into her mind, she felt her whole body flushing with mingled delight and shame. Ah, it was easy to say they'd all been drunken, or to excuse herself that what was done that night was done with Arthur's consent, indeed, at his urging. Still, it was grievous sin, adultery. And since that night she had hungered for Lancelot, night and day, yet they had hardly been able to face each other. She couldn't look him in the eyes. Did he hate her as a shameful, adulterous woman? He must despise her. Yet she longed for him with terrible despair. After that Pentecost, Lancelot had hardly been at court. She had never thought he had cared so much for his mother, nor yet for his brother Balin. Yet he had mourned them both deeply. He had been away from court all this time.
"I wish," said Guy, "that Lancelot were here. Who should accompany the Queen on a mission of this sort, except that knight Arthur has named as his Queen's champion and protector?"
"If Lancelot were here," said Morgaine, "many of our troubles would be over, for he would settle Meleagrant with a few words. But there is no good talking of what cannot be. Guinevere, shall I ride with you and protect you?"
"In God's name," said Guinevere, "I'm not a child who cannot stir forth without a nurse. I will take my chamberlain, Sir Lucan, and I will take Bracca to dress my hair and lace my gown, if I am there for more than a night, and to sleep at the foot of my bed. What do I need more than that?"
"Still, Guinevere, you must have an escort fitting your rank. There are still some of Arthur's companions here at court."
"I will take Ectorius," said Guinevere. "He is Arthur's foster-father, and nobly born, and a veteran of many of Arthur's wars."
Morgaine shook her head impatiently.
"Old Ectorius, and Lucan, who lost an arm at Mount Baden? Why do you not take Kai and the Merlin with you as well, so that you may have all the old and the lame?"
"You should have an escort of good fighting men who can protect you, Guinevere, in case it is in this man's mind to hold the Queen to ransom, or worse." Guinevere repeated patiently,
"If he does not treat me as his sister, then his claim is worthless. And what man would offer any threat to his sister?"
"I don't know if Meleagrant is so good a Christian as all that," Morgaine said. "But if you're not afraid of him, Guinevere, you know him better than I do.
No doubt you can find an escort of old bumbling veterans to ride with you. So be it. You might offer to wed him to your kinswoman Elaine, to make his claim of kinship even more valid, and set him as regent in your place."
Guinevere shuddered. remembering the great coarse man dressed in ill-tanned skins and furs.
"Elaine is a gently reared lady. I wouldn't give her to such a one," she said. "I will talk with him. If he seems to me an honest fighting man, and such a one as will keep the peace in this kingdom, then, if he will swear loyalty to my lord Arthur, he may reign upon the island. I like not all of Arthur's companions either, but a man may be an honest king without being a good one to sit with ladies and talk in hall."
"I marvel to hear you say so," said Morgaine. "To hear you sing my kinsman Lancelot's praises, I thought you believed no man could be a good knight unless he were handsome and full of this kind of courtly matters."
Guinevere wouldn't quarrel again with Morgaine.
"Come, sister, I love Gawain well, yet he is a rough Northman who trips over his own feet, and hath hardly a word to say to any woman. For all I know, Meleagrant, too, may be such a jewel in the wrappings of a knuckle-bone, and that is why I go thither, to judge for myself."
So the next morning Guinevere set forth with her escort of 6 knights, Ectorius, the veteran Lucan, her waiting-woman, and a 9-year-old page-boy. She hadn't visited her childhood home since that day she left with Igraine to be married to Arthur. It wasn't far, a few leagues down the hill, and to the shores of the lake, which at this season was drying up into boggy marshes, with cattle grazing in the summer fields, and lush grasses filled with buttercup and dandelion and primrose. At the shore, 2 boats were waiting, hung with her father's banners. This was arrogance, that Meleagrant should bear these unpermitted. But after all, it was possible that the man genuinely believed himself Leodegrance's heir. It might even be true. Perhaps her father had lied about it. She had landed at these very shores, bound for Caerleon so many years ago. How young she had been, and how innocent. Lancelot had been at her side, but fate had given her to Arthur. God knows, she had tried to be a good wife to him, though God had denied her children. And then despair washed over her again as she looked at the waiting boats. She might give her husband 3 or 5 or 7 sons, and a year might come of plague, or smallpox, or the throat fever, and all her sons would be gone. Such things had happened. Her own mother had borne 4 sons, yet none of them had lived to be as much as 5 years old, and Eleanor's son had died with her. Morgaine! Morgaine had borne a son to their evil god of witches, and for all she knew, that son lived and thrived, while she, a faithful Christian wife, couldn't bear any child, and now she might soon be too old. Meleagrant himself was at the landing, bowing, welcoming her as his honoured sister, gesturing her toward his own boat, the smaller of the 2. Guinevere never knew, even afterward, how it happened that she was separated from all of her escort, except for the little page.
"My lady's servants may go in the other boat. I myself will be your escort here," said Meleagrant, taking her arm with an over-familiarity she didn't like. But after all, she must bear herself with diplomacy and not anger him. At the last moment, with a momentary sense of panic, she gestured to Sir Ectorius. "I will have my chamberlain with me as well," she insisted. And Meleagrant smiled, his great coarse face reddening.
"As my sister and queen desires," he said, and let Ectorius and Lucan step onto the smaller boat with her. He fussed about spreading a rug for her to sit on, and the oarsmen pulled out into the lake. It was shallow, grown heavily with weeds. In some seasons it was dry here. And suddenly, as Meleagrant seated himself beside her, Guinevere was seized with an attack of the old terror. Her stomach heaved, and for a moment she thought she would vomit. She clung to the seat with both hands. Meleagrant was too near her. she moved as far away as the dimensions of the seat would allow. She would have felt more comfortable if Ectorius had been near. His presence was serene and fatherly. She noted the great axe Meleagrant wore through his belt. It was like the one he had left near the throne, the one Balin had seized to murder Vivian. Meleagrant said, leaning so close that his heavy breath sickened her,
"Is my sister faint? Surely the motion of the boat doesn't trouble you? It is so calm."
She edged away from him, struggling for self-control. She was alone here except for two old men, and she was out in the middle of the lake, with nothing around her but weed and water and the reedy horizon. Why had she come? Why wasn't she in her own walled garden at home in Camelot? There was no safety here. She was out under the wide open sky, so that she felt sick and naked and exposed.
"We will be on shore soon," Meleagrant said, "and if you wish to rest before we conduct our business, sister, I have had the Queen's apartments prepared for you."
The boat scraped on shore. The old path was still there, she noted, the narrow winding way up to the castle, and the old wall where she had sat that afternoon watching Lancelot run among the horses. She felt confused, as if it might have been only the day before, and she was that shy young girl. She reached out surreptitiously and touched the wall, feeling it firm and solid, and stepped through the gate with relief. The old hall seemed smaller than when she had lived there. She had grown used to great spaces in Caerleon, and later at Camelot. Her father's old high seat was spread with skins like those Meleagrant wore, and a great black bearskin lay at the foot of the seat. The whole looked uncared for, the skins ragged and greasy, the hall unswept, with a sour, sweaty smell. She wrinkled her nose, but it was so much a relief to be within walls that she didn't care. She wondered where her escort had gone.
"Will you rest and refresh yourself, sister? Shall I show you to your apartments?"
She smiled and said, "I shall hardly be here long enough to call them mine, though it is true I would like to wash the dust off my hands and take off my cloak. Will you send someone to find my serving woman? You should have a wife if you are to think of being regent here, Meleagrant."
"There is time enough for that," he said, "but I will show you to the apartments I have prepared for my queen."
He led the way up the old stairs. They were also ill-kept and neglected. Guinevere, frowning, thought less well of choosing him as regent. If he had moved into the castle and restored it, had installed a wife and good servants to keep it well, with fresh hangings and good cleaning, and smart men-at-arms, well.
But his soldiers looked more villainous than he did himself, and she hadn't yet seen any woman about the place.
A faint qualm was beginning to steal over her. Maybe she hadn't been too wise to come here alone, not to insist on her escort accompanying her every step of the way. She turned on the stairs and said, "I will have my chamberlain accompany me, if you please, and I want my woman sent for at once."
"As my lady wishes."
He grinned. His teeth seemed very long, yellow and stained. She thought, "He is like a wild beast," and edged against the wall in terror. Yet it was from some inner reserve of strength she drew to say firmly, "Now, please, call Sir Ectorius, or I will go right down into the hall again until my serving woman is here. It isn't seemly for Arthur's queen to go alone with a strange man."
"Not even with her brother?"
asked Meleagrant. But Guinevere, ducking beneath his outstretched arm, saw that Ectorius had come into the hall after her, and called, "Foster father, accompany me, if you will, and send Sir Lucan to find my servant." The old man came slowly up the stairs after them, passing Meleagrant, and Guinevere put out her arm to lean on him. Meleagrant looked but ill-pleased at this. They came to the head of the stairs, to the chamber where Eleanor had once dwelt. Guinevere had been in a little room behind hers. Meleagrant opened the door. It smelled stale and dank